From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it. You can do it right now, if you would. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Happy Thanksgiving. We would ordinarily be serving up leftovers from the rich buffet of past interviews, but it's a different kind of holiday this year. With so many of us choosing to limit contact with family and loved ones to reduce the risk of further spreading COVID, we wanted to share some brand new conversations for those who may need some company and inspiration. And with that, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief Radio.
And that's what I began to call dancing in the midst of God's earthquake. So I decided to try to explore what that would mean for the next couple of generations and how practically, not utopianly, but practically, we could take the steps that would make dancing possible.
Rabbi Arthur Wasko is a prominent political activist and prolific author, the founder of the Shalom Center, dedicated to the goal of reunifying political action and spiritual search. He has served as director since 1983. With a new book, For These Troubled Times, Dancing in God's Earthquake, The Coming Transformation of Religion, Rabbi Wasko will be with us later in the hour.
This idea hit us to, you know, what if we had a restaurant, a standalone restaurant with no prices on the menu where anybody could come in, pay what they felt was fair, and, you know, get a good healthy meal.
It was May 2007 that we first visited the same cafe in Denver, Colorado, a nonprofit initiative called So All May Eat. It was an inspiring story, and frankly, having found out that the cafe where some pay but all are fed is still going strong all these years later, we wanted to share it with you this holiday weekend, and you will hear it. But first,
I think I started defining my relationship with God.
My spiritual identity has changed.
I rarely think about God.
I put into question a lot of things.
The Creator may have set me on that path.
It means a lot more than it did when I was younger.
It was a groundbreaking project, a film documenting the religious perspectives of six American teenagers, a diverse group representing Buddhist, Catholic, Muslim, Native American, Jewish, pagan, as well as Protestant traditions. What Do You Believe was directed by Sarah Feinbloom and appeared in the year 2002. Now, Sarah is back with a follow-up project titled What Do You Believe Now? And I am delighted to have the director with us today on State of Belief Radio. Sarah Feinbloom, welcome to this show.
Thank you so much.
What do you remember most vividly about the original group of young people you worked with for What Do You Believe?
I mean, I just remember all of them. There were six of them that I chose out of 200 young people. So already just from the get-go, they stood out, all six of them, because they were... It just kind of bubbled to the top of the potential subjects and ended up choosing them. You know, I remember their adolescence and their struggles as young people trying to make sense of their worlds and of their personal lives. I guess that's kind of what I remember. I remember visiting their families and being in their, you know, schools with them and filming them in their bedrooms, you know, with their posters and their stuffed animals and all the things that teenagers have.
Mm-hmm. Were the people that you featured in the new film drawn from that same original group?
Yes. They were the exact same six. I went back and found all six of them to follow up with them. So you, in the documentary, you see them as each of these six people, you see them as a teenager around age 16, and then you see them at 32. So you really get a kind of a broad look at mm-hmm. the development of this individual person over time.
Is there one striking change that you noticed that applied to the greatest number of the participants?
When I went back 17 years later to find out what had happened to them, all of them had some very interesting twist or turn to their religious and spiritual beliefs. Some of them kind of became more personally spiritual, but maybe less officially religious. Some of them had completely left their faith tradition. Some of them had returned and in a sort of stronger way. So, I mean, all of them went through a transformation. That's for sure. And I think that's probably true of all of us, that as we mature and as life happens to us, we begin to refine and shift our beliefs. And that's what I'm really interested in, is how our beliefs change over time and what causes them to change, to deepen, to shift, to the ways we reinterpret life and faith and those big questions. Yeah.
What was most noteworthy for you, or maybe surprising to you?
One of them who I thought was straight, who I thought was a heterosexual kid, turned out to be gay. That was a really big sort of shift, and I didn't really notice any clues. One of them who was super devout, and I thought would never ever leave their faith tradition, had kind of left. Not completely, but had really, really sort of moved away and wasn't so dogmatic, you know. But I mean, for me, because as a documentary filmmaker, when you film people and their lives, you become pretty close to them and you know a lot about them. And so, I mean, for me, the thing that was sort of was most moving, I was surprised, but I figured they had changed. And I think it was just more very emotional just to be with them again and have them share. You know, they share a lot of personal stuff. They talk about their relationships. They talk about death. They talk about struggling with things. And so for me, that was just a very emotional and rewarding experience to be reconnected to them after 17 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, of course, I mean, people change over two decades, but the world has changed as well. And I wonder if you're able to hold those two truths separately as you look at the faith journeys of your subjects, or if you even think there's a point in trying to do that.
Right. That's a really good point. You know, I think some of the ways that the world has changed, and you can talk about this group because these are millennials. You can talk about they grew up very differently than I did. They grew up in the internet age. They have a lot more access to ideas and sharing of knowledge. They, you know, are exposed to a lot more, to other faith traditions, to other beliefs, to meditation, to astrology, to things that maybe their parents didn't have as much access to. And so I think there's a way that this group of the young people that I documented in What Do You Believe and What Do You Believe Now, that they really were influenced by the society that they grew up in. And I think that makes them sort of more open-minded, but I think it makes them less of an adherent to one particular belief. And so I think there's a trend with millennials, with people under 35, where they call them sort of unchurched, or they call them the nuns. This is a very high percentage, maybe 33%. Don't go to church anymore. Don't identify with any particular religious tradition. But I don't think that they're not spiritual. I think that they are spiritual. And if you ask them, their spirituality is much more kind of like a a la carte spirituality. Mm. Like they went to the big buffet table and they chose a bunch of different things from different traditions. And they actually still believe in some kind of higher power, and they still pray, but they're doing it in kind of new ways. And I think maybe in that way, the young people that I documented reflect some of those larger trends. So that's really interesting. But I also picked young people who were really questioning. Mm-hmm. I didn't pick, you know, maybe as mainstream young people, because I was interested in the questioning. I was interested in the grappling and the conversation that, you know, happens when someone is questioning their why we're here and what's the purpose of life and why do we suffer and what is death and, you know, all those big questions that religion tries to answer. Mm. So, yeah.
What can we learn from these life and faith journeys?
Hmm. Well, I wish that you would answer that question, because sometimes it's hard for me. I mean, people have said different things. Sometimes people they reflect on their own journey, because this is not a proselytizing film. This is not a film that sort of teaches you to believe X, Y, or Z. Mm-hmm. This is a film that invites you to go along on these journeys and reflect on your own adolescence and your upbringing and how you personally have evolved, and to kind of understand the richness and the possibility in your own evolution as maybe you were a Catholic when you were young and then you kind of fell away and then you decided to return to it and you went back to the scriptures and when you reread them, they meant something different to you. Or, you know, maybe you are a Buddhist, or maybe you were never a Buddhist, but you've become one now because it resonates for you. So, I mean, I think that's the invitation is there in the film to the viewer to reflect and to kind of see what happened to someone else and kind of question your own beliefs. Mm-hmm. And why you hold them and why they matter to you, and to hopefully be in dialogue with other people to express them. I mean, one of my big goals of the original film and this one is for people to have interfaith conversations where they learn about each other and begin to demystify the other and appreciate the other and respect the other's perspective. And I've done a lot of these kind of conversations with the original film and hope to do it with the new one, because right now we're so divided. We're even more divided. And I think if we could get together and talk, we might begin to see some commonalities, and that might bring us back together. And I think that, you know, that we all kind of have very, like, even these great faith traditions, they're not that dissimilar. They actually hold a lot of the same values, and I think that's really important. So I don't know. That's what I hope.
Sarah, I have to ask you, as you have looked and learned from these people that you have filmed got to know, how have the changes that you saw in them impacted, if at all, changes in your perspective on belief?
It's so hard because I'm such a kind of, I'm sort of an outsider to my own faith tradition. I'm Jewish, but I wasn't raised in a religious way. So I'm a very complicated story, which is probably why I took on this project. I mean, you know, some of the sort of profound suffering that some of them experienced is really, I think that sort of witnessing them and how they made sense of it and how they kind of tried to put their lives back together. This isn't really sort of maybe it is kind of a belief or faith question. There's something about, and I think that's why we also flock to community and religious places, is to not feel so alone in our personal suffering, so being able to witness and kind of hold space for other people, for the death of a parent or their own feeling of wanting to die and sort of grappling with that inside their own and how, what that means for them. I mean, those are really profound experiences to talk about and to witness. So I guess for me, sharing that and not feeling as alone, maybe that sort of affects me. I don't know. These are hard things to talk about.
Yeah.
Don't you think it's hard to talk about religion and spirituality? It's so elusive. It's like,
of course,
how do you describe some of these things? But
that's why I ask other people that question, because I want to know the same thing. Yeah. Tell our listeners what they need to know about Good Docs and the work that you do, as well as how how congregations and schools can access these films.
Oh, thank you so much. Yes. So I also represent a whole bunch of other filmmakers through my distribution company. It's called Good Docs, GOODDOCS.net. And not all the films are about religion and spirituality, but there are some, including mine, and educators and congregations can find the film there, and you can do a screening, you can do a digital, like a virtual screening, you can also even get a DVD, believe it or not. You can also invite me and the young people in the film to speak to your group. We really want to get the film out there. We really want to talk to interfaith groups and religious congregations and sociologists of religion and people who work with young people and social workers, because we think this is a real tool to help understand diversity and to create dialogue. So please reach out to us at gooddocs.net and we'll help you create, you know, put on a screening or whatever you'd like to do. And that would be really wonderful. Yeah. And we're going to be at the Interfaith Film and Music Festival coming up. I think it's in December. And, you know, the young people in What Do You Believe, they're really wonderful. They're from all these interesting different backgrounds. And they all want to talk to community groups. So, And so invite us. We'll do a Zoom when we can travel again. We'll come visit. We really like talking to groups. And So thank you for this opportunity.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Yeah. Sarah Feinblum is an award-winning filmmaker and educator, most recently the director of What Do You Believe Now? From Good Docs. Sarah, thanks for being with us today on State of Belief.
Thank you. This was a lovely way to start my week. I really appreciate talking with you. Thank you so much.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. I'll talk with Rabbi Arthur Wasko, author of the new book, Dancing in God's Earthquake, The Coming Transformation of Religion. And later, a Thanksgiving story from the Mile High City and the Same Cafe. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy. Rabbi Arthur Wasko has been a political activist, a peace advocate, and a prolific author for many decades. I've had the privilege of being a colleague of Arthur and working with him on several different projects through the years. His new book is titled Dancing in God's Earthquake, The Coming Transformation of Religion. And I am really pleased that it brings Rabbi Wasko back to State of Belief Radio again. Arthur, welcome.
Well, shalom to you and to all your listeners.
There is an energy in your writing, almost an excitement at the spiritual potential the kinds of upheavals that we've all been living through can unleash. Does that resonate with you?
Yes, absolutely. I think, to tell the truth, that we're living in the kind of awakening time that the Roman Empire brought about. One aspect of what it did was crush the older spiritual and religious communities of the Mediterranean basin, including biblical Judaism, and unleashed new energies as people tried to figure out what to do. And among the new energies were certainly both rabbinic Judaism and Christianity. So what happened was really exciting. It took a couple hundred years to work out what was going to really work out of that earthquake. Several earthquakes brought on by Rome and the Hellenistic empires. And modernity, I think, has done the same thing to every traditional religious and spiritual community on the planet. We're all in a state of earthquaking and God wrestling, and we're looking to see, and not just looking, but acting to see what we can do. So dancing as a metaphor for me came to describe what we're doing as the dance floor itself started shaking and quaking and moving.
Yeah. Are you seeing a growing number of people who are recognizing this thread in our current day?
Yes, I am. There have been several responses, as there was 2,000 years ago. One response 2,000 years ago was people saying, shrugging sort of, and saying, well, this Hellenistic philosophy stuff, it seems very smart, and abandoning the spiritual ventures. And some people today are saying, well, you know, science and secularism seems to work pretty well, even though it gets us in a lot of dangerous spaces, including even the ultimate dangerous space of endangering life on the planet. Can't get more dangerous than that. And at the same time, there are these bubblings of house churches, independent fellowships, explorations, people rediscovering the indigenous communities, people who have been scornful of their own dead-end religious communities going to Standing Rock and discovering there was real energy in the indigenous communities standing against the oil companies' depredations, and realizing that part of the strength of the resistance was precisely in the spiritual roots of the resistance. So I think a lot is going on that is looking in new ways, not the old ways, but in new ways at the old tradition.
Arthur, as a lifelong peace activist, from where do you draw the kind of hopefulness that permeates your writing as well as your work at the Shalom Center?
Well, I lived through 15 years of earthquakes that really made some very important changes in American society. Not enough, but very important ones. And even knowing that there was a 30-year reaction, some of that change, a great deal of that change, has not been rubbed out. In fact, I think some of the changes we were able to make have been crucial in providing the platform for the set of changes that have been bubbling the last 5 or 6 years and have become so important in the last even year. So some of us who were active in the 60s and 70s have seen the work we've done, even damaged, wounded, recurring with new life and new energy. We've lived long enough to be able to see that and seen that it's made a difference now, and it's making a bigger difference at the grassroots and even national election. So I think that's the sense of hope, that old line going back to an abolitionist minister and repeated by Martin Luther King, that it takes a long time for the arc of the universe to bend for justice, but it does bend.
What will be the most important, significant transformation of religion coming toward us?
Well, I can tell you what I think will be. I think the images of domination and subjugation, which we still, even as we move toward a fuller democracy, keep as images in such deep ways, King, Lord, are beginning to shift as we move toward what I see as a much more ecological way of seeing the world. And I don't mean just ecology and biology, seeing it in the way with which different biological species fit together, but as the way in which cultures and politics fit together, not being dominated. I mean, for instance, who knew that our brain, which we thought was in charge of everything, is deeply affected by millions of microorganisms in our bellies that we didn't even know existed, even just 20 years ago, that they are there and they affect the way our brain works. That's a much more ecological sense of how our humanity is than everything is top down. Literally, in this case, it's not top down. I had a wonderful conversation with my oldest grandchild 11 years ago when she was 8 years old. I asked her what she thought it meant that the Torah says that God created human beings in God's image. And I'm stumbling over the pronoun because she then was she, and now 11 years older, feels beyond the binary, so wants us to use they, and says it's even retroactive till then. So I'll use they. So the first thing they said to me was, what's an image? At 8 years old, what's an image? So I said, well, like a photograph. And they said, like a photograph? But God's invisible. How could there be a photograph of God? That doesn't work. Long silence. And I didn't say a word the rest of this conversation. The conversation was totally in their head. And the heart, more even than the head, I think. And they said, well, I guess it could be the other way around. Maybe God is in the image of human beings. You could take a photograph of human beings. Long silence. But we're all different from each other. It couldn't be just one of us that makes the image. Long silence. We're all different. Wait a minute. Maybe we're all different from each other the way the pieces in my jigsaw puzzle are different from each other. You got to fit us together. And if you fit us together, we make a community. And a community is more like God. Wow. That was the best Torah I learned in 50 years. And it's more, I never thought of a jigsaw puzzle as an ecological game, but it is. What ecology teaches is that the species are, it's important that they're different from each other because they have to fit together. If they don't fit together, you can't become an ecosystem. And the ecosystem is the one. And the one can't happen unless it's, the pieces are not only different, but different so that they fit. And that was an amazing piece of wisdom from an 8-year-old and from anybody. So I think our religious life is moving in a direction not of top down, not of the great chain of being, which says a rock has very little worth because it has very little consciousness, and plants have a little more, and animals have a good bit more, and human beings have even more. And at the top of it all is the royal God, the King, the Lord, who has all consciousness. And we're just schleppers, servants of the great consciousness. But this says something different. This says that each of us has a consciousness. All of us have a consciousness that we need to fit together and make the one, the unity, out of our sharing our differences. And I think we're moving there. We've learned to move there partly because we're struggling with what it means to live on an earth of different species, that if we don't act that way, we're going to do ourselves in and everybody else with us.
A focus on universal connectedness can be very heartwarming to contemplate. But in the present day, what do you say to those of your readers who see true evil spreading among humanity, and the last thing they want to feel is that they themselves are unavoidably a part of that?
Uh-huh. Well, I think we're at a choice point. We can either, the whole human race, can either look toward the way in which we do fit together, or some of us can decide they want to be in charge. But getting to be in charge takes more and more and more and more force and violence. and so much so that it means death and increasing amounts of death for every species, including our own. I think there are ways beyond it. I've been working recently on, okay, what does it mean? American society is divided almost in half from people who are newly struggling to be accepted as part of the full American democracy, and other people who have long been considered part of the American democracy, and many of whom are shuddering at feeling forgotten as we move to broaden who is supposed to be included. So there are the newcomers, mostly, many of them at least, are not new to the society. They're just new to being included in who's supposed to be paid attention to. And there are the people who feel they're newly forgotten. They used to be paid attention to, but they're not anymore. So I've, for instance, thought about the following as policy. I mean, there are two levels to this. First, I think there needs to be more direct dialogue. And there have begun to be organizations that are creating literal face-to-face dialogue between blue America and red America, to use the labels that have somehow gotten attached. But that's not all. There needs to be policy that talks with and for most groups, for the people. And one of the things I've thought about is this. I've talked about the notion of a federal policy to support neighborhood, and I mean neighborhood, solar co-ops that will fund the solarization of groups in neighborhoods to be able to cross the barrier from burning fossil fuels to solar energy. Why? Well, A, at the most immediate, it saves money. If you can make the initial investment, and that's what I'm imagining the federal government doing, it means that you're practically free electricity. And by the way, the federal government in the 30s did that with the rural electrification programs when farmers didn't have electricity and they were left out of an incredible advance in technology. And the federal government said, we don't want farmers left out of that. And they did it through co-ops. They said, you form co-ops and we will fund your electrifying. And it worked. And hardly anybody remembers it. It worked so well. It just seems normal and natural now. So what we need is that every neighborhood be able to access renewable energy through solar co-ops. Co-ops, not just individuals, because co-ops can gather together, can make themselves effective units to push for this happening in other neighborhoods and bring in people in the neighborhood who might have been reluctant. And rural neighborhoods, small town neighborhoods, suburban neighborhoods, urban neighborhoods who aren't ready to do this on their own, aren't able to perhaps make the initial investment. The point is to dissolve this blue versus red, where half the country thinks maybe the whole climate question is a hoax, and in any case, I'm not interested in doing it, and make it possible for the local group to meet its own needs, both financially and humanly, meet job needs, so that neighborhoods that have become hollowed out and are suffering, the death rate goes up as people, what people call drug overdoses, but are deliberate suicides by using various drugs. And other neighborhoods in big cities where the jobs are terrible. There may be jobs, but they're terrible. And dead-end jobs are also able to move ahead in the world. And meanwhile, the Earth itself is able to breathe. So evil emerges when the society acts as if we are enemies, and some people, in order to protect their hyper-wealth, want two halves of the society to continue to treat each other as enemies. So the people who want enmity and rage and fear, those do have to be politically defeated. But huge hunks of the society can become allies, both culturally and economically and politically, if we start seeing that the alliance is not only on behalf of the Earth, it's on behalf of each other. So that's at least my own understanding of what the religious transformation would be in our generation.
And I can't let you go without taking a minute or so to talk about the work of the Shalom Center, which you founded in 1983 and still lead today. What should our listeners know about that?
Well, first of all, they can find our website at theshalomcenter.org. You have to have that theshalomcenter.org. And it's very rich in materials for celebration, for prayer, for mostly but not only Jewish celebration. It's got a lot of material for Christian and some for Muslim as well. Not much for other traditions, though, a little bit. That's the first thing. The second thing is we've worked especially on the Earth connection, the relationship between Adam, the human being, and Adama, the Earth. The only way to do that in English is Earth and Earthling. And I try to use that because the two words in Hebrew really show the interwovenness of Earth and Earthling, that it's real. The words imitate the reality. Environment means really it's out there, it's somewhere separate in the environs, but Adam, Adama means it's deeply interwoven. So we learn from that, and we are working on that as well.
Rabbi Arthur Wasko is a peace activist, a political advocate, and a prolific author whose latest book is titled Dancing in God's Earthquake, The Coming Transformation of Religion. He continues to lead the Shalom Center, which he founded in 1983. Arthur, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Weldon. Thank you, and thank all your listeners. Shalom once again.
It was way back in the spring of 2007 that we first brought you the story of the same cafe in Denver, Colorado, where the word served as an acronym for So All May Eat. So much has changed in our world in these 13 years. What are the chances that a local kitchen dedicated to, quote, creating community through access to healthy food would still be standing? Turns out, same cafe is still going strong. Here's a look back at the heartwarming story from the State of Belief archives.
Brad Berkey is the proprietor of Same Cafe, a restaurant he opened with his wife Libby about 7 months ago. It's an unassuming little dining space on a stretch of Colfax Avenue in the downtown area. When you walk in, There's Brad behind the counter, cooking up today's menu for all to see, deep in conversation with his customers. The shop's yellow stucco walls are decorated with inspirational quotations, all dealing with the concept of giving. And then there are a list of rules, the very last rule being the one concerning payment. You could sum up that rule by saying there is no rule. No, there aren't any prices on anything. You simply pay what you think the meal is worth and what you can afford. In the cases of some customers, they pay what they can, and sometimes that doesn't mean money.
My name is Brad Berkey. I am the co-owner of the same cafe, So All May Eat Cafe, here in Denver, Colorado. We came up with the idea, it was a progression through years of volunteering at different shelters and soup kitchens. We were cooking, we were feeding people, we loved that part, but we wanted to make that more of our life, we wanted to do more with it. This idea hit us to, what if we had a restaurant, a standalone restaurant with no prices on the menu, where anybody could come in, pay what they felt was fair, and get a good healthy meal. I was, and still do, IT work, half, 20 hours a week outside of the restaurant, and my wife's a full-time school teacher. We don't expect everyone to be able to pay restaurant-style prices, and then we also, of course, have the option of if somebody doesn't have any money and they'd like to volunteer, then they're welcome to do so. They can come and exchange an hour's worth of labor for a meal. We keep track of the number of customers and folks that come in every day, but it's a totally anonymous. We don't know who's leaving what. We don't know if one person left every dime that's in the box and everybody else was eating for nothing that day, or if everybody was chipping in an exactly equal amount. And that was really important to us, is that we wanted people to be able to come in and not have to make known that they needed help. And Olivia and I were both raised in Christian homes, and we were raised to volunteer and raised to give back to the community, and that's really where this all came from, was through that upbringing. But there's no religious background to the restaurant itself or to our organization. We're non-denominational. We don't have any church backing us or any organization for that matter. We're self-funded. It's our own faith that started it up, and we'll keep it going.
My name is Nancy. I live in Denver, Central Denver, about 10 blocks from here. What brought me here the very first time was an article that was in the local newspaper Westward, and I've been coming back ever since because the food is so great, and Brad is wonderful, and all the people that volunteer here are great too.
My name is Juan Garcia. I live in Denver, Colorado. In this place, there's no cash register. You pay what you want to pay, and the food is delicious.
I'm Suzanne Magnuson from Denver. I had pizza and a Greek salad and a lemon cookie. It's delicious.
I'm a soup, salad, and pizza kind of person, which is what they have, and as well as cookies. But there's always a great choice, and everything is nutritious and organic.
Mostly organic foods, made from scratch. We do our own pizza dough. We have our own cookie recipe. The restaurant itself is very open. When you walk in, you notice that there's no walled-off kitchen where the cooks hide in the back and, your food's prepared and then brought out to you, and you never see what's going on. We wanted to make sure that it was, an open environment where, we could interact with everybody who comes in. We want to know about you and about your life if you want to share.
The door really is always open. It's wide open, like it is right now, and it's always like that. And so you really just get this open feeling, and then the sunflowers on every table, it just has a very happy, warm feeling.
A woman walked in here the other day that it was her 90th birthday, and she wanted to come in and check it out because she'd seen my last name, and she wondered if I was any relation to a guy that she had taught for back in Illinois in a little farm town community schoolhouse, and it turns out that was my grandpa. So, just really cool things like that, where if I was behind the wall of a kitchen, just absent from being out here in the midst with everybody, I'd probably never see that type of stuff. We have no no staff here. Our staff is 100% volunteer. That's another big factor of why we've been able to stay open as long as we have, because we have people that come in, they're able to share, you know, 5 minutes or 5 hours of their day with us, helping us do, you know, do a few dishes or, you know, sweep the floor. Without them, we'd be a lot harder pressed to be successful. There's this general belief that all people are going to cheat you somehow, but in our own hearts and our minds, it's most people are good, and if you give them the chance, they're going to do the right thing.
We have a link to the Same Cafe website at stateofbelief.com. I hope you'll look at it, or you can go directly to soallmayeat.org for more information. We've been talking a lot about leadership this week, being here at the National Leadership Gathering with the Interfaith Alliance, discussing policy with elected leaders like Governor Ritter and Mayor Hickenlooper. But, you know, people like Brad and Libby Berkey show us that true leadership doesn't have to be explained or deliberated. Sometimes it's as commonplace as a slice of pepperoni pizza.
When COVID-19 restrictions came to Colorado earlier this year, the restaurant shifted to Meals to Go, serving four times as many people as the year before. And just like well over a decade ago, the menu still doesn't have any prices on it. Same Cafe continues as a donation-based fair exchange restaurant that serves healthy food to everyone, regardless of ability to pay. You can learn more at www.soallmayeat.org. Happy Thanksgiving, indeed. Before we go, I hope all of you had a good Thanksgiving Day, though I am sure that most, if not all of us, celebrated the holiday differently from previous celebrations that were filled with cherished traditions. For me, most different this year were the prevailing emotions of the day, some of which seemed to contradict each other. Gratitude was on my mind and in my words, but so was a strange mixture of grief, fear, and anxiety, causing me to search for hope and faith of one kind or another. Yes, I gave thanks for my family and friends, but among those beloved people, like individuals around the world, the ravages of coronavirus have taken from us people we love, caused the loss of jobs, and eroded the money needed for food and housing. The prevalence of lies has rotted our trust for each other and opened our eyes to the fragility of our democracy. All of this past week, I wrestled with turbulence in my soul as I thought about patriotism, extremism, compassion, and faith, frequently asking myself, what's happening in our nation? We have had hard times on holidays before. Fear shrouded the New England table at which the first Thanksgiving meal was consumed. Fear related to survival and conflict. But a major difference distinguished that historic time long ago from the troubles around tables this past Thursday. Despite scarcity and anxiety, both the Pilgrims and the Indigenous Americans were smart enough to know they needed each other. In recent days, I guess I've been more frightened by the rhetoric and actions in our nation than ever before. My fear stems not only from health and political threats around us, but also dangerous thoughts and deteriorating values that are burning within us and tarnishing, if not setting aside completely, the moral values of our nation and the highest visions of our tradition. But my thoughts on Thanksgiving Day also involved not just troubles. I thought of answers to our problems. Faith and hope are as important parts of my life as are fear and anxiety. Our country is facing one of the greatest periods of testing we have known. Can we find strength and hope amid the complexities and evils that we face? Well, that depends on whether or not we can engage a world filled with danger and hate while still keeping our faith and hope and not becoming just like the people we most oppose. We need each other. I am thankful for teachers who, despite a terrible virus and low salaries, remain in classrooms to battle the plague of ignorance and tease young minds into deep explorations into new fields of study and progress. I'm thankful for scientists who are helping to answer the prayers from those of us longing for cures for diseases that continue to rob us of precious lives. I'm thankful for journalists who tell the truth so that the truth can inform us and even in some instances set us free. Each of you has your own list of reasons for gratitude, I'm sure. The strange mix of emotions that I experienced on Thanksgiving Day may be an insight into the near future and a revelation that fear, grief, death, faith, hope, and gratitude can live together, must live together. The first Thanksgiving was neither easy nor tranquil as myths depict it. Archaeologists tell us that the first Thanksgiving meal's menu likely was not turkey, but coon stew, or as one historian called it, special game casserole. But the people at the meal gave thanks. Surprisingly, as I remembered Thanksgiving and the grand American legacy of that tradition, I found myself inspired and motivated to not give up. It's far better to celebrate Thanksgiving together, expressing gratitude for forebears who believed life at its best requires freedom, understands and practices mutuality, shares community, invites into the neighborhood a family that just arrived from another land, and welcomes strangers in need. We need to get together, friends. Every Sunday, the First Church in Plymouth recites a contemporary version of the Mayflower Compact, a document that seems sacred to me. I share with you a paraphrase of those words now as a Thanksgiving gift that can enhance our lives, intensify our love, and motivate us to feel gratitude. Here is that version of the Mayflower Compact. We pledge to walk together in the ways of truth and affection as best we know them now, or may learn them in days to come, that we and our children may be fulfilled, and that we may speak to the world in words and actions of peace and goodwill. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. One day, they may thank you for doing that. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.